Hadi bakalım.
Our favorite Hillary Clinton acolyte is back. Catherine Marr is testifying before Congress on NPR and her role there, as you know, all that stuff. So we'll be digging into that. The Trump admin is neck deep in deportations. Unfortunately, some of those are student visa holders simply for criticizing a foreign government, which shall not be named. And plus, the internet is being giblified, and the IP people are big mad about it. So we'll begin into it. I think we're going to have some debate today. It's going to be a lot of fun. Let's go.
I look forward to it. Everybody, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome back to another episode of Human Reaction, your weekly source for independent commentary on cultural news and politics, where it's always our mission to arm you with the tools you need, the mental models, to figure out what the fuck is going on in the news. Because it's really hard to tell sometimes, isn't it, Kyle?
And oh, yeah. So you know what's going on, you got to hit the subscribe button so you can keep being informed on those things.
Exactly.
Or leave us a review. It helps us with the algorithm, depending on, you know, which, if you're on Spotify or whatever, do the thing on the platform that you enjoy listening to this on. All right, let's get into it.
Let's do it. This episode is brought to you by Revved Up Promo, the official apparel partner of Human Reaction. Revved Up is a premier full-service shop specializing in laser engraving, screen printing, and embroidery. Not only are they now making all of our apparel right down the road from us, they can do the same for your brand and ship it to you anywhere in the world. Revved Up helps you navigate the extensive universe of merch options and uses state-of-the-art techniques to showcase your brand in its very best light. So if you want to support our show and our generous sponsor, you can now do so by buying our merch and by turning to Revved Up Promo for your own custom apparel needs. Reach them at revveduppromo.com. That's with two V's and two P's, or just check the show notes for a link.
So starting out, I have to maybe start out the NPR discussion, I have a post from the Babylon Bee that I wanted to show. It says, NPR says they always strive to feature a broad range of opinions from slightly communist to very communist.
Now, Kyle, they would never do that.
They would never.
I mean, they employ a very balanced staff of people of all political persuasions, don't they?
Yeah, we'll get into the numbers on that. We will get into the numbers because that was brought forward in front of Congress. But maybe before we get into the actual hearing itself, kind of what, David, you teased in the intro there was, who is this Catherine Marr, who is the CEO of NPR? We've talked about her before on the podcast. Mm-hmm. I believe Bennett pulled it up for us. It was episode 73.
Mm-hmm. We'll do the link thing here
in the description below.
Or that. You can do the thing where they put the video. Okay, whatever.
Bennett, do the thing.
Yeah, we did a real deep dive. We've done through everything she did. But you know, as Kyle was saying, she's the CEO of everything. She just running around.
Like, literally was like the CEO of everything. It's kind of odd. Like, so she was the CEO of Wikipedia, which, I mean, even the founder of Wikipedia says it's a psyop.
That's true. At this point.
Kind of interesting.
And the pivot was during her tenure there. Mm-hmm. You know, from a fairly open system to a pretty closed system now that seems heavily controlled.
She's also on the board of the Signal Foundation.
Which is sketchy.
Also sketchy.
Very interesting.
Signal, for people that don't know, is an end-to-end encrypted messaging app that
Pete Hegseth likes to hang out on.
So does JD. Yeah. Excellent.
Just chatting with the boys.
Houthi Small Group.
I'm going to rename our group chat Houthi Small Group. Yeah.
I do love that the world is just kind of run off of like Signal and Telegram chats. It's kind of nice.
It does seem that way. Yeah.
It is always interesting. All the American like officials are always on Signal and they're never on Telegram, which is always interesting to me. But that's because there's always those worries about Pavel Durov maybe working with the Russians, which wouldn't make sense with this history, but there's always those worries.
Yeah.
But anyways, she's on the board of Signal, which doesn't help the thoughts that CIA does have back access to Signal. Like, there's always been those thoughts that exist there. So, but yeah, and she's also like, she was a young leader at the Global Economic Forum,
World Economic Forum.
Sorry. She was on the Council of Foreign Relations.
Yeah.
Okay. So she's got a very decorated resume of establishment involvement.
She's been everywhere. It's kind of like this, like, Where's Waldo thing. Like, she's been everywhere.
She's the Carmen Sandiego of the deep state.
Yeah, there you go.
But I will, let's take it to Congress, because the purpose of this was basically like Congress looking at them and being like, do they have political bias? Do they deserve funding? Does NPR and PBS deserve taxpayer funding?
Right.
So that is like the purpose of putting out the information here. And I thought that this clip first will kind of showcase how that all went.
First of all, I do want to say that NPR acknowledges that we were mistaken in failing to cover the Hunter Biden laptop story more aggressively and sooner. Our current editorial leadership
in Wuhan.
We recognize that we were reporting at the time, but we acknowledge that the new CIA evidence is worthy of coverage and have covered it.
A lot of it came down to they just kind of failed to cover everything important.
Look, mistakes were made, okay? Mistakes were made.
That's the past now. Now, remember, when we talked about this in 73, it was in the context of a longstanding reporter and editorial staff member quitting the organization, saying, this organization's completely intellectually bankrupt. They're completely uninterested in covering the news from any angle beyond the left. And he's a leftist, but he's like, this is not what we're here to do, and this is not our mission.
Right.
So, yeah, this is a long-term story. Obviously, that goes all the way back to the 90s of NPR drifting this way, and there being very little, like an anemic pushback to really make any difference about it. Mm. So it's good to see Congress actually trying to take some action here.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and there was some... A lot of this came out in the videos. I don't want to play every video from every congressman, right? But some information that came out is that they were often referring to various studies that were done looking into, because it's not just NPR. PBS was also here. The CEO of PBS was here. And some of the things that were kind of brought forward was, okay, NPR interviewed Adam Schiff about Russia collusion 25 times.
Modest coverage, yeah. One might say.
Yeah. But then they also laid out like, but they never interviewed someone like Chairman Comer about the Biden impeachment and Biden family illicit business dealings. That never gets covered, right? Mm-hmm. But the Russia hoax does get covered.
25 times.
Yeah.
That's a lot. A lot. That's a lot. A lot of
like getting a congressman. You know? Yeah. Other things, PBS, the study showed that between June and November of 2023, the term far right was used 162 times, while the term far left was used 6 times.
Okay. All right. That's a data point.
Okay.
PBS, 72% of their coverage of the GOP convention was negative, while 88% of their DNC convention was positive.
Wow. Okay. All right. We're establishing a trend here.
Yeah. And then also voter registration in the newsroom at NPR, 87 Democrats, 0 Republicans.
Shit. And it's like, I thought that was fair and balanced.
Fair and balanced.
Wow. Okay. So obviously a very well-established slant here, and certainly, not surprising, I would say, to anybody like kind of really paying attention from a fairly objective view of the way NPR and PBS cover things like this, right?
Yeah.
So what came out of the congressional hearing here? What were some of the high points there?
A lot of it, I think a lot of what it, I mean, with all congressional hearings, there's always a bit of the stagecraft of it all, you know?
100%, right. Yeah.
But a lot of it's clip farming for the donors. A lot of it's, you know, just kind of getting these talking points. They're hitting I have some funny clips here that I'll bring talking about genderqueer dinosaurs and things like that. But
that seems like the high point to me. I'm excited.
It was
for this
the high point. Yeah. But it's one of those things where it's like, this seems to be the staging ground for a defunding effort, mm-hmm. because that is something that appears to be on the agenda of the Trump administration, is defunding NPR and PBS.
And keep in mind, they get a substantial amount of their support already directly from private donations. Mm-hmm. So why are we giving them taxpayer funding? And that's ultimately what it is. If they were just if they're MSNBC, no one cares, right? Because that's their brand. That's who they're marketing to. So
it's
when
the
they have 87
thing.
Yeah, when they have 87 reporters are all Democrat, well, I'm sure those numbers are matched at MSNBC or even greater. But at the end of the day, you're taking my money,
right,
to go report on things that I don't think you should be reporting on. Well, and not covering things I think you should be reporting on.
Right.
It's like, this is the sanctioned newsroom where they are fair and balanced. Like, it has that prestige to it where it's like they're fair. Like, we all know people that just like, I know the truth. I listen to NPR.
Right.
Like,
right.
And they don't have any bias. They're not like Fox or CNN.
Right. Like, you know, government, I mean, funded. Like, oh, you're totally missing the plot. But how much of this is an issue of the fact that it is branded that way, that it's branded as this sort of like, oh, this is the trusted news source for the nation, mm-hmm. right? Like, mm-hmm. to me, that's a problem. But do you think that if they rebranded, if basically we pulled taxpayer funding and they became just the, you know, Democrat public radio, it would all be good.
I think the same people will probably listen to it. Yeah.
I imagine.
Yeah. A lot of smooth jazz and, you know.
A lot of soft, sultry tones.
Yeah, exactly.
I do want to pull, I'm going to pull a little bit deeper into this clip here because, like, there's a lot of things we could talk about that are kind of some of the goofy stuff that went on here. But the lead up to what I'm going to present is there was a lot of talk about reading through the CEO, Catherine Mayer's tweets about her support of the BLM riots. And there's a lot of that, and also, like, talks about, like, white reparations and her views on whites giving reparations to black people and stuff. And then it kind of turns into this scenario.
A few years ago, NPR educated America about, quote, the whole community of genderqueer dinosaur enthusiasts. Do you think that that's an appropriate use of tax dollars?
I was not at NPR at the time.
That's not the question, though. Do you think that that's an appropriate use of our tax dollars?
I think our tax dollars that we use are to be able to provide a wide range of
perspectives. I'll take that as a yes. You do believe that that's appropriate. Your health advisor at NPR also stated in an interview that, quote, fear of fatness is more harmful than actual fat. Would you like to explain how fear of fatness is more harmful than actual fat? That's an editorial at NPR.
I am not familiar with the editorial, and I don't believe that was published during my time here.
It's called Diet Culture is Everywhere. Here's how to fight it. Do you think that that's an appropriate use of taxpayer dollars?
Mm. I think any reporting on health is an appropriate use of taxpayer dollars, yes.
And you think that editorializing that fat is not unhealthy is appropriate?
I don't know what that article is, sir, and I'm not familiar with it,
this
so I couldn't say.
This is fake news. Do you think that basic accommodations like doorways or seatbelts represent, quote, latent fat phobia?
I don't have an opinion.
That's also from NPR. Do you think civility is racist?
No, sir.
No. Well, your outlet ran an article entitled, quote, when civility is used as a cudgel against people of color. Civility? That was on All Things Considered. Would you like to explain?
I'm not on the editorial side, sir. I'm not familiar with that story.
So you kind of get the point.
Oh man. That is
being,
so great.
Being kind to people of color is racist.
Often used as a weapon.
Expecting them to be civil is what they're talking about. They're saying, yeah, expecting people of color to be civil is a cudgel. And that's probably running cover for BLM riots, right? Right. Like,
right.
Yeah.
The mostly peaceful.
Yeah.
Component.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Mostly peaceful. Yeah.
They shouldn't be expected to be mostly peaceful. Who should?
And what's interesting there is, like, she thinks it's really important to run things on health. But the thing that they're talking about with health is the least healthy way to approach the question of
health.
Being unhealthy.
Right? Are seatbelts fat phobic?
Yeah, exactly.
Do we need to reform building standards to make doorways larger?
What is the probability that came from a corporate donation from Big Soda?
Well, I mean, after Influencergate, yeah, I think right? That's pretty likely at this point.
Influencergate, yeah.
Yeah.
There's a topic.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed. Wow. Okay. All right. Yeah. Great coverage.
Yeah. So you kind of get the vibe of how this went down. There were some areas that were very substances. There's other areas that are kind of like this, but they do prove a point of these are the types of articles that were happening at NPR. The final thing that I want to show is a little bit more background on her and a clip from a speech that she gave in the past. I believe this is from when she was still CEO of Wikipedia.
Yes.
And it's her talking about truth and what that means.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the most significant differences critical for moving from polarization to productivity is that the Wikipedians who write these articles aren't actually focused on finding the truth. They're working for something that's a little bit more attainable, which is the best of what we can know right now. And after 7 years there, I actually believe that they're onto something. That for our most tricky disagreements, seeking the truth and seeking to convince others of the truth isn't necessarily the best place to start. In fact, I think our reverence for the truth might have become a bit of a distraction that is preventing us from finding consensus and getting important things done.
Yeah, you're like, okay. I get it. Sometimes some issues are difficult to understand. Yeah. And then she goes, postmodern.
It's difficult to find consensus and to get things done.
Yeah.
The truth is an obstacle for getting things done.
Wow.
It's not good to be morally correct. Or it's not necessary to be factually correct. It's important to be morally correct.
Mm-hmm. You know what's
right?
wild?
That's an AOC quote, right? And it's classic.
It's proving that high school teachers everywhere during my era were correct, that you can't cite Wikipedia because you don't know where that shit came from. You don't know who's editing that on the backside of it.
Well, it's a thing. Like I've mentioned this on the pod before, is like whenever there's kind of a major controversial, I don't know, claim over the English language or something like that. One of the things that comes to mind is when the Ukraine war started, everybody all of a sudden was like, no, it's not Kiev, it's Kiev. You're right. And you can see, you can go into the backlogs on Wikipedia and see that there was like actual wars going on the editing side over the pronunciation of Kiev or Kiev, like in the week that the Ukraine war started. Right. So that's one of those things where you're like,
okay, but and I've noticed that as well. Like, what's the significance of that? Why does it matter exactly how the word is
language pronounced? Informs people's views? Like, it's a control mechanism for people, I think. And if you're switching towards the because there are two different ways that people use it, but Kiev is more the Russian way of doing it. Well, Kiev is not.
Kiev is the Ukrainian way.
Kiev becomes like a symbol mm-hmm. for the support of Ukraine in their plight against Russia.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Right?
Yep.
I see. That makes total sense. So they're basically repositioning language mm-hmm. to be more supportive of Ukraine, and it sort of becomes a dog whistle for who are you backing in this fight or what perspective are you taking?
Yeah. Well, when it comes down to like, you know, these are all the language games of like the stuff that say like Jordan Peterson was fighting about in Canada back in 2016, 2017 era, where it's like the manipulation of words that was going on in Canada with some of this legislation and what they can and can't say and the manipulation of like gender language and all the CRT stuff. Like all of these things are language games for the sake of controlling ideological thought and the direction of it.
Right.
Yes.
And it's like a constant background. So I actually put a link in the notes, Kyle. You mm-hmm. can look at it real quick. This is about the battle on how to understand Israel-Palestine going on in Wikipedia. And in this case, it's the ADL claiming that the Wikipedia has been infiltrated by pro-Hamas actors and is changing. Oh, the next one down, actually. The one above that.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, yeah. That one I want to get to next. Specifically in this case, this is a news coverage articles from how Wikipedia go up. Well, you just went past it, buddy. I can't read it when you do that.
Oh wait,
go down.
Do you want?
Yeah.
This?
Okay. How Wikipedia's pro-Hamas editors hijacked the Israel-Palestine narrative. Right. So like this is you know, if you take it that there is no truth, right? If you take it that actually keeps us from consensus, then it opens up this avenue for battle where we're like, oh, who really controls Wikipedia? And we're going to be able to cast anytime there's information we don't like on it, is like, well, that's because it's from Hamas.
The fight over narratives. Yeah. Narratives matter. Narratives are everything in a lot
Super
of ways.
Important.
Yeah. Because they drive, you know, this group pulls onto this narrative, it becomes their new like mythology that they can cult up around. This group, they have this narrative and it becomes their new mythology that they can cult up around, and then they're like fighting over these narrative wars, and it doesn't even really matter what the truth is at that point.
I mean,
everybody's just like fighting over stories.
I mean, it's so yeah. it's so important that state actors are involved in it. In the next clip,
this is the art of propaganda.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
The next clip that you had up, mm-hmm. yeah, play that. 30 seconds.
Has arranged instruction day for wiki editors. The goal of the day is to teach people how to edit in Wikipedia, which is the number one source of information today in the world. As a way of example, if someone searches the Gaza flotilla, we want to be there. We want to be the guys who influence what is written there, how it's written, and to ensure that it's balanced and Zionist in nature.
Balanced and Zionist in nature.
How do you reconcile those two things?
Yeah, it's like this is the way that I almost view Wikipedia. I think Ian Carroll he kind of says this appropriately. He always kind of puts it in good words, where it's like, Wikipedia is the things that you're like allowed to know and think about. Mm-hmm. And so oftentimes it is like useful to use Wikipedia because like, oh, well, like those are things that you're like kind of allowed to know about, right? Mm-hmm. But you're never going to find like the deeper hidden stuff that matters on Wikipedia.
For
right?
sure. For
because
sure.
it has been taken over for the sake of propaganda and psyops. And there's these psyop wars that are going on with it.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
And to be clear, that guy's from the IDF. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So like that's What's going on?
So it's like the IDF is training people on how to use Wikipedia on the editing purposes to craft narratives, right? That's what they're doing.
This is fascinating and disturbing. I mean, the interesting thing to me is the absence of objective truth creates more polarity, right? Because of just what you said. You create a narrative over here, people cult up around that, these people cult up around this. They're operating on two different sets of facts, and there's no way to reconcile the two. There's no way to come to a middle ground because there's no actual definite truth to the matter.
Yeah, you're training people's heuristics. So it's like those initial gut instincts, like you're implanting gut instincts into them. And that's when you get those moments where like a trigger word is hit, like, you know, somebody says the word Trump and all of a sudden everybody has a thing, you know, yeah. It's either like blind worship or blind hatred. He's the devil, you know, and like everybody's just kind of like, because they've culted up and they have those trigger words. They have the symbolic language around it, right?
Yeah.
Like those are the things that we're fighting against in a lot of ways.
Yes.
And we're trying to create our own in a sense too. Like everybody's trying to do that.
The goal is just trying to create something more sophisticated that can better react to reality rather than ask you to not believe your eyes when you see something and say, well, actually, there's a bigger play at hand and there's actual stuff going on behind the scenes and Trump's really president, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Well, yeah. And to operate in a realm of like rationality versus just defaulting to the emotional response that you get when a trigger word is summoned, you know?
Yeah, right. Well, and okay, so oftentimes what you do is to learn how to think slower, meaning not to go on the heuristic. You have to train yourself to be like, oh, hold on a minute. This is how I'm feeling, but is this the right way to go about it, right? And that is a difficult thing to train, especially if you're not like a professional in the area, right? So the whole idea is you create mental models to shortcut that to force yourself into thinking slower because you have pre-existing principles to say, wait a minute. This is coming from a government, or wait a minute, this is coming from a politician speaking right now, or wait a minute, that's not how prices work, or that's not how the Constitution works. And if you have those shortcuts, then you can have stopgaps to those kind of traps. So that's how I think about
it. Just like in regular educational purposes, like none of us are physicists, but we all have a general idea and instinct on how gravity works. And we've kind of like learned the basics of how that works. So we can always kind of like, we have like a general idea, but like we're not the physicists that know all the exact math on everything, right?
Yeah, but gravity is a psyop, so you know.
I mean, yeah, it's like
Globerger, you know, propaganda over here.
Yeah. I mean, it's how else do they how are they supposed to hold up those drones that they put in the sky? Called birds.
Buoyancy, dude. Buoyancy.
Those birds are very buoyant up there.
All right. I don't want to know about the genderqueer dinosaurs. I need to know what's going. Yes. This is going.
Yes.
Well, no. Well, that was he was just pointing out that there was an article on it. That was the early.
Oh, that was it.
We just got distracted.
Man, I was
there.
Hoping we'd get more on genderqueer dinosaurs.
No, apparently, unfortunately, like this was actually kind of the problem because she's a new CEO.
Yeah.
So many of her answers are, I was not the CEO at that time.
Yeah.
I was not the CEO.
But she
at
simultaneously
that time.
Claimed to not have any editorial review, so therefore, like she wouldn't. She, you know, like who do you hold account?
Yeah, that's the problem with these congressional hearings always is that they just kind of like sit behind very certain, very specific things and they don't really bring anything out. But I think what this was useful for is raising the question. Republicans have been very against NPR for a long time. Mm-hmm. But I think that now there's actually the political will to actually see defunding happen.
Right.
Sorry. Let's move on to the revoking of visas story.
All right.
Speaking of, you know, there's some PSYOP link. Like, there's a transition from the PSYOP conversation with the IDF to this, huh?
100%. Right? Yeah, there's definitely, I think the MAGA right is working hard, working overtime to justify these and while trying to remain fidelity with the Constitution. So we're now up to four that we've been able to find of students that have had their visa revoked, either permanent residents or student visa residents, green card holders. From four different universities that were all part of campus protests and campus movements criticizing Israel, usually asking for campus, at least for Khalil, which we've covered recently, we're asking for divestment from the university on Israeli-connected businesses. These guys have been picked up off the streets, and there's some dramatic video of that, or they are currently detained on each one of them.
Wow.
So...
Yeah. So we've talked about Khalil. Who else now is ensnared in this operation?
So Yunseo Chung, I think I pronounced her first name
it's
right.
Yunseo Chung.
Yunseo, there you go. So in her bio, she's 21-year-old Columbia University student and former high school valedictorian. She's currently in a lawsuit with the Trump administration over efforts to deport her. She's originally from South Korea, moved here at age 7, was the valedictorian from her high school, and went to Columbia. There she participated in some protests. I did find some videos of her participating in a sit-in in one of the buildings, but haven't found anything of her, you know, lighting a building on fire or something dramatic.
Yeah, that's the big thing with all of these, where I feel like they're getting framed in such a way where these people are kind of like participating in riots and such like that, where I'm not seeing that evidence. I've seen some things about how like some of this stuff has turned into maybe a little bit more aggressive, more than aggressive protesting in various areas, but it's not, it hasn't been huge. It doesn't seem like they seem to, in a strange way, they actually seem to be mostly peaceful. Unlike let's say the Summer of Love,
right.
In the 2020 era.
Yeah.
There's some concerns I would have here where I could see these things rising further. And I feel like that's what the state's concern is mm-hmm. stamping out potential escalation that may be occurring here. But
that's a really dubious yeah. position to take constitutionally. Mm-hmm. Are they relying on the same piece of code that they relied on to detain Khalil on this?
So far, that's what it looks like. And when we dug into it, actually, we had in a tweet that I had go viral, someone posted the actual document to kind of debunk me. But if you go over to a Kyle, 0.5 is the relevant piece of information. It's the first tab you have up, homie. If you jump into that. There you go. So 0.5, the Secretary of State has decided that basically they are a threat to national security because what they're doing is not aligned with American foreign policy.
Yeah, the point there reads, the Secretary of State has determined that your activities and presence in the United States would have potentially serious adverse foreign policy consequences and would compromise a compelling U.S. foreign policy interest.
That's an interesting phrasing on that.
That's pretty broad.
That's a pretty interesting phrasing.
Yeah.
It tampers with foreign policy interests.
Yeah.
With speech, mm-hmm. to be clear. So the code that they're referencing
It reminds me, a lot of the fire in a crowded theater justification.
Yes,
sure. It reminds me a lot
in a similar era. Yeah. In World War I, when that decision was made, which is a bullshit decision that got over, that's not actually enforcement now. But when that decision was made, what that had to do was handing out anti-war pamphlets.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So
it was primarily like this is when right wingers were super anti-war. Like it was like right wing groups who were nationalistic and they didn't want to involve themselves overseas.
It was very much like our current moment where you have MAGA first people who are skeptical of foreign intervention and very far left wing people. Now, the very far left wing people were the people who went to prison mm-hmm. in the case of World War One, but they were more likely to be much more spicy about it. Right. Some of those guys were encouraging violence and stuff like
mostly
that.
Peaceful.
Yeah. So. Yeah. But it's still in a situation where, you know, the same dynamic when your country goes to war. The temptation to crack down on speech is very real. And if you aren't aware of that history, if you're not aware that every time this happens, we put someone in a detention camp or we put someone in prison or we do whatever when they disagree with the policy, that's what the state does when it's powerful because war is the health of the state. That's where it's going to go.
Yeah.
Right. So people need to recognize that this is a lot. Just because it's visa holders doesn't mean it's not a degradation of the highest standards of strictly construing what it means to have a First Amendment.
And correct me if I'm wrong. This Yong Seo Chung, she's a permanent resident, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
But so was Khalil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because people like there's other people in here. One in particular, because I have a video on Rubio actually commenting on this person in particular.
Yeah.
It's a Rumesa Ozturk, a mm-hmm. Turkish doctoral student at Tufts University, who co-wrote op-eds about Palestinian genocide and Tufts University's ties to Israel, got arrested by like street-clothed agents caught on surveillance footage.
Mm-hmm.
But like that is a visa revoking situation that's going on with that one. And actually, here let me pull up the Rubio clip. Where we can see he's being asked specifically about her.
Sorry, a Turkish student in Boston was detained and handcuffed on the street by plainclothes agents. A year ago, she wrote an opinion piece about the Gaza war. Could you help us understand what the specific action she took led to her visa being revoked? Yeah. And what was your State Department's role in that process?
We revoked her visa. It's an F-1 visa, I believe. We revoked it, and here's why. And I'll say it again. I said it everywhere. Let me be abundantly clear, okay? If you go apply for a visa right now, anywhere in the world, let me just send this message out. If you apply for a visa to enter the United States and be a student, and you tell us that the reason why you're coming to the United States is not just because you want to write op-eds, but because you want to participate in movements that are involved in doing things like vandalizing universities, harassing students, taking over buildings, creating a ruckus, we're not going to give you a visa. If you lie to us and get a visa and then enter the United States and with that visa participate in that sort of activity, we're going to take away your visa. And once you've lost your visa, you're no longer legally in the United States, and we have a right, like every country in the world has a right, to remove you from our country. So it's just that simple. I think it's crazy. I think it's stupid for any country in the world to welcome people into their country that are going to go to your universities as visitors. They're visitors. And say, I'm going to your universities to start a riot. I'm going to your universities to take over a library and harass people. I don't care what movement you're involved in. Why would any country in the world allow people to come and disrupt? Now, we gave you a visa to come and study and get a degree, not to become a social activist that tears up our university campuses. And if we've given you a visa and then you decide to do that, we're going to take it away. I encourage every country to do that, by the way, because I think it's crazy to invite students into your country that are coming onto your campus and destabilizing it. We're just not going to have it. So,
pause it there.
All right. I took some notes on that one.
Oh, man.
All right. So first off, is it a crime to be involved in the movement?
No.
No.
Right. Not inherently.
Now, if someone else in that movement does something bad, should you pay the penalty for it, even if you individually didn't?
The individual should be punished, not you.
Yeah, yeah. So criminal law typically works by an individualized standard of evidence, right? There are some exceptions to that when it comes to RICO cases and things like that, but that has to do with conspiracy. And it actually has a relatively high standard to prove conspiracy. So unless you have communications from them saying, hey, go vandalize this building, that would be, you know, that would be a RICO case, right? That would be a conspiracy case. Mm-hmm. I don't see how they have any basis for that at that point, right? I mean, because if you came here and you're studying and you have opinions that aren't supportive of the preferred foreign policy of the Secretary of State, that isn't in the code that he can revoke you from that. What the code says is materially support a terrorist organization. Material is different than rhetorical. Mm-hmm. Rhetorical support for something you've decided to be a terrorist organization, rhetoric is speech. Material is money and resources and actual capability to advance their mission, not simply saying, I don't like what Israel's doing. Even then, I haven't found any evidence suggesting they said, you know what was great? Hamas, right? They're mostly, as far as I've seen, everything I've seen is, this is critical of the war in Palestine.
And it's like it's a concern for the Palestinian people themselves.
Yeah,
it's not necessarily like Hamas support.
But even then, it's still speech to say, "Hey, Hamas has some great points," or something stupid like that. It's still protected speech because that's not how the First Amendment's written.
Right.
Well, it's also I kind of see this not being super dissimilar to, say, like the J6 protests.
Yes,
you know, like, because like the thing where I was hypercritical of the BLM protests in the Summer of Love era because of the rioting and the burning of cities that was happening, like and the Antifa riots and in DC and things like that. Like, I haven't seen the evidence that the pro-Palestinian protests have kind of elevated to that level in any means. I there are concerns for me where I feel like they could rise to that level. And I think there's a concern there. But it's also like with the J6 protests, like I think that there's reasonable cause to like very specific individuals in there probably charged with vandalism and whatnot.
Yeah.
But the vast majority of them not.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I mean, that's kind of how I feel about this current situation.
There are J6 cases of people being a mile away from the Capitol at the time of the incursion who got prosecuted.
Yeah.
Right. For being part of the group.
Well, I mean, so, Enrique Tarrio wasn't even, he was like thousands of miles away and he got arrested.
Well, that was based upon the idea that he had incited it.
Right.
But
well, incited it was Ray Epps, who was saying, go into the Capitol, and whatever happened to him?
Yeah.
Not a damn thing.
Too.
But so it's selective enforcement, right? And which is specifically to chill speech, right? It's to chill the other side, to make them afraid so that they don't speak up. And then additionally that it's the, if you have a at the text message that says go inside the Capitol is different from I don't like the policies of Israel in a student newspaper. One is general speech about a public policy matter and someone's opinion about international a foreign country, not our country, but a foreign country. And then he's saying that's participating in an activity. Participate in that activity. That's his words. Right. And what evidence do we have that she participated in activity? Well, as far as I don't know about Ozturk, but you need to have evidence of that to have suspicion to detain somebody in the first place, according to your own rules. So whatever your ought is, your is right now with the actual legal status of what you're doing is completely off base.
Yeah.
Because in that those rules exist. Not because we love the idea of someone coming here and doing things that are critical of our government or another government. Not for those reasons. They exist because the First Amendment's abundantly clear that the U.S. government cannot make laws that infringe on the freedom of speech.
Right. Obviously, this represents a massive departure from, I think, what a lot of people expected from the Trump administration as far as their relationship and respect for the First Amendment and the Constitution. Are you noticing, are there MAGA people, are you seeing on the internet people who are supportive of this,
yeah,
these policies?
It's the same dividing lines that a lot of these things have been down in the kind of the MAGA civil war that's been occurring. Mm-hmm. It's the same, like, it's the same people on one side versus the other side. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a communitarian impulse saying, mm-hmm, we are a family, this is our family, and you're here as a guest, just like he articulated,
mm-hmm,
and you're saying something that I wouldn't allow in my household, so therefore we should kick you out. They're saying, and then if you challenge on, well, what about the First Amendment, you say, the First Amendment only applies to U.S. citizens. And you say, what is the text of the First Amendment? It doesn't say that.
No, it does not say that.
And in fact, the entirety of the Declaration of Independence makes the case that rights are inherent to the dignity of every individual. It doesn't say to citizens. And it says the duty of citizens to overthrow governments that are tyrannical. But that is talking about the duty of the citizen to act against their own government, potentially. It isn't saying that government gives you your rights and then protects them. That's not how it works at all. And in fact, in the conservative movement, that has been the dogmatism of the conservative movement for 50 years. So we're going to turn all that now on the communitarian impulse to just be like, well, they're not from here, so get out. I want zero immigration, so therefore this is good.
Yeah. Yeah, and a lot of it is that impulse of just like, you know, like when we were talking about all the H-1B visa stuff,
yeah,
where it was like, you know, my immigration policy is somewhere between zero and infinite. It's not one of those standards, but apparently that's like radical. Right. Yeah. But like, and even I was trying to, like, and you guys know, before we started the podcast, I was trying to like find stuff to steel man the other side on this. And I struggled. Just like, I was trying to look for like massive amounts of damages from Palestinian riots or things like that. And I didn't really get that stuff. Yeah. Like there's some instances of harassing and kind of like small vandalism stuff, but there hasn't been anything that's been like super big as of this point. And like I said, I do have concerns that it could escalate to that level.
Yeah.
Like that's maybe the level of steel manning I can do there. But, yeah.
But I mean, even that, I mean, you can't justify, you know, this preemptive action based on concern.
But I actually think that the blowback of this types of actions will end up, kind of escalating.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and this will be the blowback that escalates it. This is a point that I made on a prior episode. Like, yeah, by doing this, they're inflaming the issue. They're dividing the base who are half are saying, wait a minute, I thought just 2 seconds ago we respected the Constitution and the First Amendment. Mm-hmm. You've got this other side, you know, the on the left basically saying this is ridiculous. How dare you? And then you've got the, like, I guess the strategy is to appeal to like this faction of the MAGA base who is, you know, very nationalist and communitarian and just wants the foreigners out. Like, mm-hmm, what is the strategy here? I'm struggling to understand the long-term vision for this play.
Well, and this is the area where I said before that there's certain things where, and specifically on the deportation side of things, where I feel like this is where the mandate of Trump can start to disintegrate a lot,
yeah,
is if they take it too far on, like, because, like, almost all Americans are down for just deporting kind of what they see as the criminals, like, you know, the fentanyl traffickers, all the stuff going on the Mexican border, mm-hmm, all that stuff. Like most of America is behind that. But then when they start doing these like niche cases, like these types of things, that's where I feel like the mandate will start to crumble and then the base will start to be divided and it'll make the whole coalition weaker.
Yes. And I mean, this is playing directly into the left's playbook of really niching down on the individual cases. I mean, we see this all the time, right? It's fairly common political rhetoric, right? To invoke a certain individual who had this thing happen to them and use them as sort of the standard for why a policy is bad. Like, this gives the left, like, their martyrs effectively to say, mm-hmm. look how they're persecuting this person. Mm-hmm. Look how bad this administration is. Look how bad their immigration policy is because of these individual cases. They're just handing it to them on a silver platter.
Yeah. I mean, it has two benefits for the administration. One, it can either chill the speech of other people who are like, wow, I don't want to speak out because I don't want something bad to happen to me. Right. Or it'll start an escalatory spiral, in which case they get to now say, look, all these violent Hamas protesters who are out destroying our cities. Right. So if and that's they're in an all win situation with this particular policy, unless they lose the court case, in which case it's that much of a black eye.
Do you expect that they would win this court case?
Well, I mean, by a strict reading of their code that they cite, I don't see it. I don't see how they do. But you don't know.
Depends
on
the judges.
Depends on the judges. Depends on a lot of things.
But obviously, something like this goes all the way to the Supreme Court. And what does the Supreme Court say to this? From an originalist view.
You would think it would read very clearly. But
that's where we'll see conservatives being like, "I told you, Gorsuch is a traitor."
Yeah, right. But on issues of national security, in which case this is one. Because the whole appeal is that they are materially supporting a terrorist organization, the Supreme Court typically defers to the executive, right? We've never constitutionally decided if the authorizations of use of military force from 2001, 2002 are legal. They are unlike any authorization to use of military force ever in U.S. history because they are endless and undefined, right? You can, as long as we can claim it's tied to al-Qaeda, we can support al-Qaeda in Syria. That's how torturous it is. Right. So therefore, it's so insane that every time it gets to the district court level, because of prior Supreme Court level decisions, to say, well, the executive has a prerogative on foreign policy. And they just always say, well, there's no standing. You'll have a soldier who was injured in Iraq saying, I am injured because of an unconstitutional war, and then can't get standing.
That's crazy.
Yeah. So
it's madness. It's true madness. But you cite material support. You said they're going to make the claim there's material support, but you're saying there
it's
isn't.
It's rhetorical. There isn't. Well, at least we don't have any evidence of that. Because now, if they did, that would be the thing that they would roll out to say, no, he was supporting Hamas with dollars or
right. You know, yeah, and they're the not doing that, which is not winning them the PR battle on this. So
unless there's some intelligence that we're unaware of or something
right.
But that's one of those things where we would be unaware of,
which
that
I'm
we would never
to.
Know that.
Any of these four people could have been, could have hurt somebody or done something terrible, right? But the question is why aren't you charging them with assault or charging them with property damage questions? And then he's also moving the goalposts. He's saying, well, they might harass somebody. Harassment is a campus policy. That's up to the university to decide to say, okay, that got to the place where we're going to kick you out of school now, and then you can revoke their visa because they're now kicked out of school. That's a provision in which you can be kicked out of school.
Yeah, but that's like a total trap that makes sense to take.
Yes, yeah. Right. Or destabilizing campus. What does that mean? You know, your speech could destabilize, right? Like, your speech is what they're doing is they're saying you can't protest or doing a sit-in. Sit-in is a property rights violation of the campus. So they have standing to then say, hey, you are in trespass, so we're going to have the police arrest you now, right? That's within the campus's ability to do, but the campus isn't. So why does the federal government need to come in and do it now? Well, come on, guys. What it's really about is Miriam Adelson gave a gobs of money to the Trump administration and said, you know what we want? We really want to make sure we don't get any more campus protests. So stop the campus protests. So they're trying to silence them by doing what they can, because they can't do that to the native-born students.
Well, and we saw, the same type of policies being implemented by various states when it came to anti-Semitism laws and whatnot. Yep. Like, this has been a trend that we have been seeing this rise in hate speech in regards to a very specific group, which I thought is something that we were kind of against this whole MAGA coalition.
Do you remember when conservatives were against free speech zones on campuses?
Yeah. Yeah.
How is this different?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, I mean,
well, in regards to very specific groups too, this has always been the kind of wokeness of the right is when it comes to, Israeli stuff. Well, the left has kind of their genderqueer African American stuff.
Dinosaurs, don't forget dinosaurs.
And they're dinosaur enthusiasts, I believe is what they phrased it as.
Exactly.
And this is that version of it.
Yeah.
And then this is where it seems to be the dividing line of the MAGA coalition is the people that are along our milieu of what, how we're discussing this here, is there's no exceptions on the free speech. There's not like special groups that should be had. Well, then there's other ones that are kind of, they're like, oh no, we'll make an exception for this group. Mm-hmm.
Consistency, principles, people need them.
It's dangerous.
Yeah, I mean, it was literally in the comments of that tweet that went pretty well, was people saying, I had principles on free speech, but then you did COVID, so now I don't have any.
You did COVID, Dave.
Yeah, I did.
You did.
Just how blaming me for COVID.
And I am going to pull up footage of Dave at the Wuhan lab.
I am going to make that.
David's just like,
generic bald guy.
A little bit more fun news, we could say, is Studio Ghibli, Ghiblification, has taken over the internet over the last 2 days because of a ChatGPT update where everybody is Ghiblifying everything.
Okay, so you're going to have to clarify for those of us that aren't familiar, what the hell is Studio Ghibli?
Studio Ghibli is an animation studio that has made various very big anime movies over the last several decades. Like, they're like 30, 40 years old. Mm-hmm. Some of the big ones, I haven't actually watched a lot of Ghibli films, but like Princess Mononoke.
Yeah, Spirited Away.
Spirited Away. Yeah, those are some of the most famous ones.
Most recent, Boy and the Heron. And these are, Joey, you would love them. They're beautiful. They're animated and incredibly detailed. And they have like a childlike innocence to them. While exploring really profound psychological themes and philosophical themes, that it's really superb.
It's like if Jordan Peterson was anime.
Yeah. Yeah, you could say that.
Right on.
Yeah, something like that.
Hell yeah, brother.
Yeah.
Hell yeah, brother. And what its result is, so this comes out of, like, and you can kind of see Sam Altman made his profile to kind of go alongside that. Uh-huh. But people are doing all sorts of things like historical moments. Like, people will have the Ghibli style on, say, the Trump assassination with the fist up in the air.
Oh, yeah, I did see that.
You know, like various historical moments that have occurred, like
Stalin.
Yeah, Stalin.
Ghiblified.
People are just doing it everything, because it's always just like, insert image. Can you Ghiblify this?
Yeah.
And then ChatGPT makes it.
Should we do one?
If you got 4.0.
I don't have 4.0.
Oh,
yeah. ChatGPT.
Yeah, I don't either. Yeah. But if there is a...
I'm premium Grok. I'm not premium ChatGPT.
I'd made the same switch. So they released a new version of ChatGPT, which had some improvements in their image generation. And that's what triggered all this. And so everything is getting Ghiblified. Like, everything.
Here, let me just pull up. I'll just type in Ghibli Trump, and I'm sure I'll get some stuff here. Here from Ian Miles Chong. My favorite Malaysian.
Favorite big Coca-Cola.
Yeah, so
sponsor.
Like, people are kind of using this imagery.
Is that Mark Zuckerberg?
Trump at McDonald's.
Kind of coming through the wall there, but we get the point.
I mean, you can say the way it's detailed and undetailed at the same time, like the pastel colors.
Yeah. the moment with JD Trump and Zelensky. You know, for audio listeners, you're obviously not seeing this, but you can probably picture.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you this is the type of stuff that's been going on.
Oh, we got Barron Trump down here with his moment with Biden at the inauguration.
Yeah, look at a good old Barron.
That's so sad. You know what? You're right. The animation style really lends a sense of innocence.
Yeah, it does.
It's a very unique style.
But that's what I love to see in Stalin. Like the greatest mass murderer of the 21st century.
Yeah, it's like maybe not appropriate
in a Ghibli style.
Resetting.
Yeah, well, it's actually really funny at that point. It's just like the contrast.
Oh, you think mass murder is funny, David?
Yes, 100%.
Oh, yeah. Good. Just one on the record,
I guess.
Yeah, and it's been fun for, like, people are changing their profile pictures. Brands are doing it. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just like, I'll even show you guys. Actually, here, I'll show you guys this first. The White House even posted one, and it's funny. They're posted one about a deportation, specifically talking about deportations, where they showed... it looks like... I'm not sure if that's the
best...
It's
not a good look. It's not a good look.
Yeah, because it kind of just looks like a woman being really sad.
Yeah.
There is context to this photo, which is maybe important to maybe just steel man, is that this is what she actually looks like. And she's a fentanyl trafficker.
Oh, so, Jesus Christ.
So I feel like the Ghiblification makes her look a lot more innocent than she actually is.
Yeah, the initial look when I saw, I was like, oh, that's a bad look, man. Like, not with this style. It just isn't coming across right. But then when you find out what actually happened.
Yeah, and she had actually been previously deported as a fentanyl trafficker. And this is her second time being detained by ICE.
Wow.
But that's her original look. But the giblification makes it look kind of makes you kind of feel for her, actually.
Yeah,
quite. Again, another innocence. Weird strategic misstep.
Yeah,
and maybe it's not weird. We're establishing a trend here.
I think the idea of doing a giblification was a good idea. It just this one didn't quite hit the mark.
It didn't hit the mark
because, like you said, Joe, the style makes it feel kind of innocent.
Yeah,
yeah.
I'm developing empathy for this person right now.
That's not what you want.
And I don't think I should have that for a fentanyl trafficker.
No,
you know?
No, I don't think so.
But a lot of the conversation that's come around, and this has been a conversation around. LLM, large language models, a lot lately. We covered in a Skiff episode the mysterious death of a former OpenAI employee who wrote a big op-ed about the copyright issues going on with OpenAI and his critiques of Sam Altman and things like that. That's behind the Skiff for Skiff members. Mm-hmm. You can go to that and see our coverage on that. So a lot of the conversation is coming around IP and copyright. So here's a tweet. It was reported yesterday that OpenAI will be doing $12.7 billion in revenue this year. Its CEO is advertising his product by infringing on the copyright of an artist who at best will do less than 1% of that in his lifetime, Hayao Miyazaki. I love to play with these tools too, but actively market it / or use it for profit, it's rotten. It's very rotten. And this is the sentiment of the hyper IP intellectual property types, I guess, when it comes to AI. How do you guys feel about this? Specifically on not necessarily broad views of IP, but like views of AI and the conversation around copyright infringement.
My take?
With the training data.
Yeah.
Everything is Ghibli. It's great. It's a wonderful moment. I get it, but you really can't copy. I mean, like this kind of hard copyright and trying to use it as if OpenAI's revenue is somehow like indicative of something they're taking from someone else, to me, that's how ideas work. That's not how art works. That's not how any of this stuff works. And it's not as if Sam Altman was selling like
bootleg Princess Mononoke copies.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that'd be a very different scenario. Yeah, that seems different to me, to be a clear violation of property right.
Yeah.
And that you created a creative product and someone's stealing it.
That's my attitude in general as well. My attitude's similar, like stealing the characters and the brand stuff where the, like Ghibli art style, it's like you could almost consider it like a sub style of anime as a whole. Like, like, you know, anime when you see anime, it's very different than like American cartoons like SpongeBob or something. Yeah. Like the way the line work usually is, but then it's like a subgenre is kind of this Ghibli style that they have in all of their movies, right? Mm-hmm. But like, is that style something that can be like copyrighted? That seems strange to me. Like, you know, I feel like Princess Mononoke can be copyright. Yeah, but like
it's like if Sam Altman would have to hire Miyazaki from his role at CEO of a
institution
in order to make an avatar of himself in a similar, you know, image.
Which isn't even that great.
He looks like the most generic random NPC character in a Miyazaki film.
He looks like a standard anime protagonist that has like nothing going for him in the beginning of a show.
Yeah, this is like Ash from Pokemon, like grown up a little. And, like, he like hung up the Pokemon.
He's, like, before, like, he took the hat off.
Yeah. He's got a desk job now. He works for a tech startup or something. Yeah.
And Joe, you're a musician, and you like.
Yeah, I mean, I would say contrary views on IP from a lot of libertarians because, you know, it's a part of what I've done for a living in my life. And I empathize with, you know, people that put their heart and soul into creating something and then to have it, you know, ripped off or monetized in a different way, it's damaging to income. And I understand that perspective. This feels a little bit different, like, because you're saying it's like a genre. It would be as if I was a, like you made the point, if I was a progressive rock musician and I had a catalog of music and someone came along and also created progressive rock, it would be like me saying, hey, you can't do that because this is my style.
Yeah. Right.
You know,
or like only one person can do claymation.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Or like I'm the only like psychological thriller author allowed to make psychological thrillers or something, you know? in this case, to your point, David, I mean, I think this actually elevates their brand.
Yes, right? So
like,
much.
Like, oh, this yeah. is pushing this animation style, which I was relatively unfamiliar with prior to this, out into the mainstream, and will probably result in increased sales for the work.
This is probably some of the best free marketing they've ever had.
For yeah. sure. Right?
You're going to watch Princess Mononoke now. All right.
Unlikely, but
let's do it. You know, well, hey, we'll sit down, we'll take some edibles, and we'll watch Princess Mononoke. It'll be great.
Oh, yeah. I'll see you in a week.
Yeah. Because
that's like, a joke. Don't do drugs, kids.
Yeah. Yeah. Because, like, the thing with, you know, like, there's like another example that came in my mind was, say, like, in the comedy world, a lot of coming up comedians, they'll take influences from the big dogs in their cities at the time. Like, if you're a New York comedian, you might be like Dave Attell or Patrice O'Neill or something, and you kind of take their style a little bit, and it informs their style. But the problem in comedy is people stealing jokes.
Right.
It's not mm-hmm. stealing their style.
Right. Yeah.
It's joke thievery. Like, that's one of the things that Joe Rogan famously did at one point, is calling out what's his name, Carlos Mencia,
right,
yeah. on joke thievery,
which is obviously right? being handled by the voluntary institutions of reputation,
yeah.
right? Which is a far better way to handle it. The same thing with stealing recipes and like French cuisine within the high levels of cuisine. If you just take something from someone else and people realize that, you're going to, it's going to downgrade you in terms of your ability to do that, especially if you don't do it with credit. You say like, hey, this is inspired by this chef.
Mm-hmm.
Then you can do it, right? But then those sorts of norms and values are a better governor of this than violence, than the force of law.
Yeah.
Because oftentimes the force of law is then weaponized by people who are closest to power to keep Mickey Mouse as being something that's out of the public domain forever.
Right.
Right.
Well, and I guess I went on that kind of character perspective. How does this conversation, the IP conversation, travel into like the fan fiction world, where people will like take characters that have existed within, you know, a studio's collection, and then elaborate on the story?
Like, is it like the monetization of it?
Yeah. That's what it is. As long,
if you're a Harry Potter fan fiction author or something, right? Like,
if you're giving
what
it away,
is the role
fine.
Of that within, you know, J.K. Rowling? Like, what is her... Should you have to license that from J.K. Rowling to be able to use that or something like that?
A great example is the author of 50 Shades of Grey was a Twilight
fan fiction
author who then took her storylines and then just put it into the non-magical world and then created 50 Shades of Grey.
But then at that point, it's like, okay, there's inspiration, which all art takes inspiration from the predecessors of it too, right?
I mean,
so like that's just taking inspiration. Like if you listen to, say, Brandon Sanderson in the fantasy world, yeah. like he talks about that all the time, is like a lot of fantasy authors, what they're doing is like, I'm going to take this concept from here, this concept from here, this concept from here, and I'm going to mash them together. And that's going to be kind of my story,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so you're taking inspiration and you're kind of, and like there's a,
that's a perfectly normal thing to do.
That's how art tends to work.
It drove me crazy when I was playing music, and I did that fairly seriously for a little while. One of the things I hated was when people would be like, hey, I really liked your band. You sounded like somebody, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was often, it was a compliment, but it was also like, it sometimes came with like I'm just like stealing their style, as opposed to like, no, they're an influence on me. I sound like those guys because I really like this guy's drumming, or I really like the way this guy handled his vocal trick here, or whatever. That would drive me crazy.
Yeah, I get that. I mean, obviously intended as a compliment, but maybe it's not perceived that way from the other side of the stage, if you will.
Right. Yeah.
It's a very interesting conundrum. So do you think the problem here is that people are looking at this and going, okay, Sam Altman's profiting on subscriptions to ChatGPT. He's taking this style and then, you know, allowing people to use it. You know, like what's the beef on the IP side? What are the arguments being made?
Part of me thinks that a lot of this IP conversation is kind of masking an act, like much more a fear of AI in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And like, there are some people that actually are concerned and they kind of have this artist streak, and they might have kind of your attitude around like music and things like that, which I actually kind of sympathize with in some semblances. But I think a lot of people are kind of like, they're using that as the type of weapon that they can use for their fear of AI. I think there's a lot of that's going
on. It's a symbol for the threat that AI may pose to animators or to creatives generally, or knowledge professionals. I mean, I was speaking with a friend actually last night who got into a bit of a legal battle with a former business partner, and the business partner who was being, you know, removed from the business hired an attorney, and he spent $60 on 3 months of ChatGPT to write letters back, giving, or actually I guess it was Claude, but he was like, he ingested all of the letters that he got that were received and mm-hmm. laid out the basically the framework of the situation, and Claude wrote him angry letters back, and and eventually they just went away. And you know that the other guy was spending thousands of dollars on an attorney and he spent $60. I was just laughing my ass off at this story. But so, I mean, it does present a real threat to people who make a livelihood doing things in this realm. So perhaps you're right that it's something that they're just sort of holding up as a warning.
In some way, it's not. I'm not even suggesting. I think some of it might be from the people that make their livelihood in this realm, and they're not wanting to adapt to new technologies, and they're a bit of Luddites on that. But I also think it's just like even beyond that of like people that aren't even on the creative side. They just have this like fear of AI.
Yeah.
And so like they're looking at this as a reason to hate AI.
Yeah.
Even though they don't really care about the IP thing as at all.
Right.
I think there's a lot of that.
It's that. It's jealousy for them making a lot of money. It's like it's just post hoc rationale for I don't like AI, so I'm going to work backwards from there on generating arguments. One of them being it's an infringement on intellectual property.
Yeah. Like I've had and it really is like to me, I feel like I would be curious to see what their Studio Ghibli's next quarter numbers are compared to their last quarter numbers.
We'll have to put a pin in that and come back and check.
What has been the viewership? What has been the Google search trends? What has been like, to me, this feels, it's actually an example is the TV or the movie Despicable Me.
Yeah.
They took, unlike how Disney operates with their IP on their characters, which they're a lot more
holding it in.
The Despicable Me thing was just like, yeah, we're not going to do any copyright stuff on anybody that uses our stuff, and we're just going to let like businesses go on ahead.
Yeah.
Put it in front of your stores if you want to.
Hmm.
And that made them, and that seems to me to have made is it two movies? I don't know. I've never even watched it.
There's like six now. But it's gotten so big because boomers posting like GIFs of Minions as like funny gifts.
Yeah. And like the Minions became a like cultural icon that then boosted the sales for the movies. Mm-hmm. So like opening up your IP restrictions in a sense, like, and just not enforcing IP law on your own brand mm-hmm. was actually a very big beneficial strategy for them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Kyle, I pulled up the Google Trends for Studio Ghibli search. Mm-hmm. I put it in the notes here if you want to. Check it out. It's quite interesting.
It's good. Interesting. It's loading.
And while it's going, I'm serious. We can go watch Princess Mononoke. it's such a good show. I mean, it's really, really, it's some of the best. Like when you think of like archetypal storytelling that really touches on like the nobility of the human spirit, it is so good, dude. I'm telling you.
I appreciate that. I tend to spend my free time outdoors, but I might make an exception for you because you are so adamant about this. I appreciate that.
Yeah, so look at March 26th. I believe this is when it happened, is right in this time frame.
Yeah, it was pretty much.
And then look at the uptrend. It's massive.
Oh, wow.
Look at maybe...
Is that a percentage? Is that how it's working? Is that out of...
I'm not sure what the scale is there.
When you mouse over, what's the number representation? 3 out of 100?
I don't know what that is. I'm assuming that's probably like...
Is it of internet traffic?
No, I think it's probably...
100% was...
I imagine it's probably like out of... Oh, look, related topics.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Google, please label your axes.
Jeez.
Is one like... 500,000?
Go to the question mark. Yeah, the question mark will tell us.
Let's commit.
Numbers represent search interest relative to the highest point on the chart for the given region and time. Value of 100 is the peak popularity for the term. So it's reached peak popularity in the last 7 days.
Yeah, let's increase the time frame. I'm very curious.
Yeah, that's what I was going to do next is let's do 2004, sure.
Oh, see that?
All right. Well, so it reached peak popularity, looks like.
This was probably some major movie
something. That's when Boy and the Heron
But the dotted line here at the end represents what just happened. It's obviously still kind of pending
or
whatever.
It's like they released a movie without releasing a movie.
Yeah.
And the Boy and the Heron was the most recent one. It's the most recent in a long time. They take forever to make movies. It's a very long development cycle for them.
Wow.
So it's
20 years.
It's only wins.
It's at 75% of peak popularity for the search term in the last 20 years. Yeah. As of 2 days ago.
That's crazy.
Wild. Well,
yeah.
There you go. I think we rest our case.
Screw
here.
IP laws. Abolish them all.
Maybe not.
It's all bullshit.
It's one of those things where it's like, I'm in a weird middle ground. It's kind of like my zero immigration versus infinite immigration, where it's like, I think there's a lot of things that are kind of considered IP that I'm like, those shouldn't be considered IP, but there's also a level of like, I think brands should have some sort of ability to save their brand from some sort of like nefarious activity. And there should be some level of protection from that in some, like, in some society.
Where it gets even crazier is when you start talking about individual likenesses, right? And there's AI bills going through state legislatures right now, basically saying if you're rich enough, you can pay to have people not be able to use your likeness for AI.
I mean, that's interesting because I remember this was maybe a year or more ago, but there were like adult, there were actresses who were being, whose likenesses were being inserted into like
Scarlett
adult
Johansson
films.
Was like a very big one.
Like really objectionable content.
In the legal side,
And I mean, so I kind of understand that where it's like, okay, like this is getting so capable as a technology that it's almost indistinguishable from reality. What's the line that we're going to draw there as a society?
Which I get it. It's very controversial and very difficult to
new
navigate.
Technology causes all these waves that society now has to figure out and discuss and codify the rules around, right? So much of this is just like we're in new territory. And so new rules need to be figured out on how we handle that. Like what are the norms that our society is going to have around these things?
Yeah. Yes, sir. Well, guys, any final thoughts before we wrap up?
No.
All right.
Time to watch some Spirited Away.
Let's do it.
All right. We're going to go watch some anime. Thank you guys so much for tuning in. This has been an episode of Human Reaction. For David Rand, Kyle Mack, and Bennett, our wayward brother, I'm Joe Sheehan. We'll see you in the next one. Thanks for tuning in to Human Reaction. Please be sure to like, follow, subscribe, and give us a review on your podcast platform of choice. And if you want to become a member and support the show financially, check out humanreactionpod.com.